Before we get started, a quick disclosure. This podcast is for entertainment purposes only. Nothing you hear is an offer or a solicitation to buy or sell any investment. And with that, hello and welcome to the Rangeley Capital Podcast. I'm Andrew Walker, Portfolio Manager at Rangeley. With me, as always, my co-host and Rangeley's founder, Chris DeMuth. It is Monday, October 3rd, and today our episode is all about complaining. We're going to start by talking about Salesforce complaining about the LinkedIn-Microsoft deal, and then we'll move on to Harvard's editorial board complaining about the endowment's performance. So, Chris, let's start with LinkedIn-Microsoft. Just some background. We mentioned the LinkedIn deal on our June 14th podcast. And, you know, LinkedIn found itself in a bidding war with between Microsoft and Salesforce. Microsoft ultimately won, but it kind of turned strange after there. The background documents reveal Salesforce just, LinkedIn kept saying, hey, I think we're going to go with someone else, and Salesforce just kept raising their bid. Microsoft ultimately won, and then LinkedIn, or Salesforce sent LinkedIn an email that said, hey, we would have bid even more for you. We didn't know that we were competing or what the price we were looking to pay was, but we would have kept going up. Why did you stop negotiating? Well, now LinkedIn and Microsoft, they're really only waiting on European regulators to clear the deal, and then it will close. U.S. regulators have already cleared it. And Salesforce is actually lobbying in complaints to the European regulator to try to prevent the deal, maybe delay it, prevent it, do something. So, Chris, what do you think about the tactic of Salesforce protesting the deal to regulators? Do you think this has any chance of impacting the deal? Kind of, it's a strange strategy. Have you seen it before? Let's talk about it.
Well, it's much easier to impact, throw a wrench kind of in the process than in the ultimate conclusion. So let me start at the end. It's a $196 deal. It's an ironclad definitive merger agreement. When there are multiple bidders, it tends to result in tight deal contracts. It certainly did here. The ARB spread right now is about $4.12, 12% IRR to a close in December. I think the deal is going to be able to be closed. If you want to look at a contract verbiage, the company material adverse change section, the material adverse effect language, and you want to judge it in 2 seconds, glance at how short the MAT clause is and how long the carve-outs are. This is a short section and long carve-out. I think the deal is going to get done. Do I think they're going to be able to push the EU into an extended phase 2? Nope, I don't think they're going to get to do that either. As you said, it's been approved already in Brazil, the US, and Canada. Mark Benioff, the CEO of Salesforce, tried to complain in the US, didn't really get traction. And I think that they will fail to get it extended. I think if necessary, they can just do a phase 1 licensing fix, if that's even necessary. He's right that, you know, the EU competition commissioner has really been concerned with concentrated databases. Maybe this qualifies, maybe it doesn't. Salesforce's fix, of course, is to have Microsoft buy LinkedIn and then share its data with Salesforce. I mean, in theory, Oracle too, but it would really be Salesforce. So you could just pay off the mugger if you wanted to and close the deal. And I think this is just, you know, he didn't just lose. He was used by LinkedIn and Catalyst, their advisor, to really kind of get them involved, very much to squeeze out the top dollar from Microsoft. They got another $2 billion or so, knowing that their client LinkedIn did not want equity from Salesforce.
Yeah, so I think there's a couple of interesting things. And the one I want to dive into is, you know, Microsoft could stop Salesforce's, most of Salesforce's complaining if they just license all the data that they're getting from LinkedIn. But if they did that, that would kill the strategic rationale of the deal, right? Both Microsoft and Salesforce wanted LinkedIn for all of that unique customer data on people's professional resumes that they were getting. And, you know, I have to wonder, is this the start of kind of a, not even a cold war, a hot war between Salesforce and Microsoft? Look, since the LinkedIn deal closed, Salesforce bought a Microsoft Word competitor, and then Microsoft put out a press release announcing that they had signed a deal with HP to replace Salesforce for their customer management stuff. They signed a partnership with Adobe to compete with Salesforce on marketing software. And Salesforce signed a deal to switch their cloud web hosting from Microsoft Azure to their big competitor, Amazon's AWS. So I have to wonder if this is actually the start of a all-out war between Microsoft and Salesforce. And if it is, you know, how that plays out for Salesforce. And I'll let you take the first crack at it.
Absolutely. I think that most CEOs are often very smart, but they also got there by being very competitive. And then in a deal environment, that competitive streak that's so common to CEOs, such as the Salesforce CEO, is then also amped up by their equally competitive Goldman Sachs bankers that kind of egg them on to win. And when they don't, I think that the kind of competitive streak has kind of run a little wild, and the animal spirits here are being competitive in a sort of adversarial way on both sides, maybe especially Salesforce.
Yeah, and I want to dive into the competitive spirits a little too, because I thought it was interesting. You know, one of the reasons a lot of people think Steve Ballmer kind of didn't succeed and was ultimately ousted as CEO of Microsoft was unable to partner with any other tech company doing almost anything. Mm-hmm. And I actually saw some quotes where Salesforce's CEO said, look, if Ballmer could have partnered with us on a couple things, he'd still be here, but he couldn't. And the great thing about Satya Nadella, who is now Microsoft CEO, the great thing about him is he understands the power of these partnerships and he's able to partner with other companies. And now Salesforce's CEO is coming out and tweeting that Microsoft's deal for LinkedIn is uncompetitive, throwing in lobs at the European regulators that say this deal is uncompetitive. Is his ego kind of getting in the way and he's unable to work with other CEOs? You know, Salesforce is not a tech giant like Google, Facebook, or Microsoft. They are much smaller. And if he can't partner with them, they might kind of be left behind in this battle between the big tech giants.
Absolutely. And for what it's worth, I think that competition commissions should look at competitor complaints as being pro-competitive, yeah, not anti-competitive. If your competitors hate what you're up to, you're probably serving your customers well.
Yep. And the last thing I wonder, you know, 2-3 years ago, Salesforce has relied very heavily on a growth model, right? Mm-hmm. We talked about this in a couple of our prior podcasts. They do deals, they do a lot of them, and sometimes the street questions their deals, but to date, the street has been wrong for every deal that they've questioned. But you know, the deals that you're doing when you're kind of a $1 million company do not move the needle when you're a $1 billion company. And Salesforce is now like a $20 billion+ company. That means they're competing with Microsoft, Google, Facebook for all of these deals. You know, they lost to Microsoft for LinkedIn. They're probably going to lose to Google for Twitter, or else they're probably going to have to massively overpay because these companies have much bigger platforms, much more financial resources, much more synergies to buy these companies. So I wonder if Salesforce is kind of seeing the writing on the wall that the future is going to be a little bit bleaker unless their competitors have their hands tied behind their back when they're looking at acquisitions.
Maybe it is. I followed Salesforce deals for a very long time. I can think of no company that has increased its market cap as much as Salesforce's has done relative to how skeptical I've been of their deal making and prices they pay. Mm-hmm. I mean, they just serial acquirer and deals that at the time, you know, I guess I can look back and say it's worked out much better than I would have expected.
Yeah. The last thing I guess I would think is, you know, since the news that they bid on LinkedIn and are considering bids on Twitter has come out, Salesforce's shares are down 15%. While, you know, since May, we've talked about it endlessly on this podcast. Tech stocks have been on a huge bull market, driven a lot by a lot of private equity and strategic interest in buying them. I have to wonder if investors are starting to question, like, is this the end for their accretive deal making? I'll give you the last thoughts for 10 seconds if you want it.
I think the advisors should just get Microsoft to launch some kind of bid for Twitter, and they will be able to get Mark Benioff to pay anything for it whatsoever.
Get that ego going. All right, so Chris, let's turn to the Harvard Endowment. Mm-hmm. So we discussed the Harvard Endowment and its struggles with hanging on to top talent a little bit in our August 8th podcast. And last week, the Harvard's editorial board actually sent a letter calling the endowment's subpar returns quote unacceptable. This was after it lost $2 billion in its fiscal year 2016 and failed to match kind of peer Ivy League schools' returns. Just as an example, Yale's endowment was up 3.4% over the same time frame, while their endowment dropped 2%. So Harvard's editorial board said it was unacceptable and called on the school to look at all ways to increase returns. So Chris, let's have a discussion. What do you think about this? How can Harvard's endowment increase returns?
Well, you know, first of all, I saw this piece in the Crimson, and the headline was "The Urgency of the Present," and I thought this could be written by millennials on any topic whatsoever. Yeah. This could be Pokemon Go. This could be getting their parents to send them more money. This is just the moment that they live in is just so much harder than anything that came before or after. And these, you know, Harvard kids are just the victims of the century, if not the millennium. And in this case, it's because they're down to $36 billion amongst the 29,000 of them. If they liquidated today, that would be $1.2 million per kid that they would have to suffer under. And they're just in a wrenching gloom over this.
Mm-hmm. So look, I 100% agree. And the $1.2 million is so funny. You know, all these schools that are constantly, they've become more kind of fundraising arms with schools attached to them. It's crazy to have that big of an endowment and to say we need bigger returns, we need more money to constantly go fundraising. Go ahead.
And money's supposed to hold value, but it's also supposed to force trade-offs. And when you have that amount of money, you have no trade-offs. So, I mean, they would probably be more competently managed if they had half or maybe even a tenth the size endowment. But what are they supposed to do? I mean, I think that these Harvard students are like CEOs. They're highly competitive. They're clearly very upset that they are losing to Penn, Princeton, Yale, MIT, and even Columbia. I mean, some of these schools that are just barely Ivy Leagues kind of are crushing them. And I think that this is deeply upsetting. But it's not clear what tools they have to move such a big number.
But I think you said something astute there, or I think you said multiple astute things there. I think the problem is divided into two problems. Mm-hmm. There is the problem with endowments generally, mm-hmm. and then there is a problem with Harvard's endowment specifically. And the problem with endowments generally is these endowments are huge now. They are, you know, they had fantastic returns in the early 90s, and we talked about this on our August 8th podcast, and a lot of that was driven by there wasn't much competition in the private equity and hedge fund worlds. So they had fantastic returns because they were smaller with less competition. But now a lot of that has been efficient market arbitraged away. Mm-hmm. So their returns have come down as their size has grown and their strategies have gotten more picked over. So that is the efficiency problem with what has happened with them. Then there is just on the efficiency problem, you know, over the past year, the best performer was Yale's endowment, which gained 3.4%. But if you were in a simple stock bond portfolio, you would have made 4.8%. So you're underperforming very simple index funds. So there's that efficiency problem as they've grown. The Harvard's, go ahead.
If only Yale had underperformed by more, Harvard would be perfectly happy. They just need Yale to have lost. I mean, the funny thing about this maudlin melodrama is 5 minutes ago or so, or last time I checked, when performance was stellar, they were complaining that successful money managers at their endowment with aligned incentives were getting highly compensated. Yep. So how, you know, and since we looked at this, the new chief has been appointed, NP Narvekar, and he has a 100% chance of getting attacked because he's going to underperform, or if, by God, he outperforms and gets paid for it, he's going to get attacked for that too. So, I mean, that is a tough job to be left
with. And that's exactly where it's going to go. The other issue is a Harvard-specific issue. You are underperforming peers, and I think a big part of it is Harvard has been unique in attacking the payouts of their top management. In fact, Yale, David Swensen was very highly rewarded for running Yale's endowment very successfully, and I don't really remember a lot of pushback for how much money he was making when he was outperforming markets. And Harvard's case, look, they had investment talent. They criticized the pay package, and maybe investment talent is happy to work at Harvard when they're getting paid 95% of their worth on the private market because it's their endowment and it comes with social benefits. But if you're trying to cut them down to 10%, they're just going to leave and go elsewhere. And I think that's a huge problem with Harvard.
I think the new guy should definitely drive a Prius, not spend any of the money he makes, draw attention to anything that he consumes. And then he should also try to sabotage Yale, because if they can just somehow manage to hurt Yale, I think this whole thing will calm down. But I mean, how do you move tens of billions of dollars like that? I mean, there's nothing that we do professionally that you could scale up at that size that is kind of edgy, actionable, mispriced, that the market's missing. It's just basically broadly allocating to exposures. And like we said, you know, the Yale model is something that was a specific time in history where that was mispriced, and that's done.
You know, the other thing is, if you are going to get criticism for underperforming Yale, there is one solution to this whole issue that Harvard can consider, and that is just go ahead and outsource your endowment management over to Yale. I don't see why they don't do that.
I think they absolutely should do that. And there's a lot of other good business options. You know, you can sell Chotskys, you can sell all sorts of Harvard related things. My favorite thing, just to hark back to LinkedIn for a minute, is when people prominently put Harvard degrees on LinkedIn that are not real degrees, but are kind of like long weekend seminars at Harvard. Yeah. And then they kind of like, yes, Kristy Meath, kind of a Harvard executive weekend program, and then put this there. And I think that's a very bearish sign for available talent. But clearly people pay for these things. Yeah. I think it's kind of thousands of dollars for a few days. So they just need to, they need to sell out. I mean, they have a good name. They have a good name brand. And I think they just can crank a lot of value for that and get back on top.
You know, if you deal, I deal a lot with small caps, and especially with small caps that are kind of family controlled. A lot of time you will see, like, you know, the CEO's son is getting groomed to take over the CEO spot, and they'll put in his bio, you know, he went to the local community college, but, you know, he's getting groomed and he also took a long executive weekend course at Harvard. So they'll say he's the perfect managerial role. He's graduated from Harvard's business school for a weekend, which I just love. And it does speak to the power of the Harvard brand name. So, Chris, unless you have anything, why don't we wrap it up here? Great, so that's all the time we have for today. Before we hit our disclosures, just a quick reminder, if you like this podcast, the best way to get more of them is to recommend us to a friend and get them to start listening. Disclosures, none for me. Chris, you're writing that you own LinkedIn, I think that is?
Yeah.
All right, so Chris owns a little bit of LinkedIn. Those are our disclosures, and we will talk to you later this week.